You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new proposal would create harsher penalties for people convicted of assaulting nurses on the job. We'll talk with an advocate for the legislation about why harsher penalties are needed. Now, for anyone who's shopped for a flight out of Milwaukee in the last 30 years or so, this might sound familiar.
When you fly Midwest Express, you still feel close to home. There's a touch of Milwaukee laughter, and you can feel the pride. You know you get the best care in the air throughout the sky.
We're still trying to figure out what Milwaukee laughter is exactly. That's a commercial for Midwest Express Airlines, billed as Milwaukee's hometown airline from 1984 until it went out of business in 2010. But now the airline is making a comeback. It's announced a few regional destinations and plans to start flying later this year. But the airline industry has changed a lot over the last decade, and that means Midwest will feel a bit different this time around. Joe Tashler is a business reporter and editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by looking back a little bit. Can you talk about what Midwest Airlines was like in its heyday and what made it so successful?
Well, Midwest in its heyday was just an incredibly service-oriented airline that provided amenities to flyers that you just don't find anymore. I mean, you can ask people. I had somebody tell me about how they flew from Milwaukee to Boston on the old Midwest Express and had a lobster dinner en route, two across leather seating, just an amazing level of customer focus and customer service.
Don't forget those freshly baked chocolate chip cookies, too.
You know, the cookies are the one thing that other than the brand name, that is the one thing that really resonates with people. Readers will just call me out of the blue and say, "Hey, are they going to have the cookies?" And they are. I've had people in the industry tell me too, "Hey, you don't mess with something that works and that people really remember." So yeah, they have to keep the cookies, and they're going to.
Well, and certainly back then, which wasn't that long ago, but it certainly seems that way, you know, travel has changed a lot, and a lot of people now see flying as kind of a necessary evil to get to where they're going. But in its heyday, as we said, Midwest stood out even from other companies that were doing more than they do today, and customers felt a real loyalty to them.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the fact that the airline started in Wisconsin and built itself as a hometown airline, there was a tremendous amount of civic pride in that. You don't see a lot of cities the size of Milwaukee that have their own homegrown, home-based, successful airline that's flying nonstop routes all over the country. And that Midwest Express was just a tremendous, tremendous point of civic pride for a lot of people in Wisconsin and Milwaukee.
So what happened? What drove Midwest out of business?
That all changed when the price of a barrel of oil hit, $105 a barrel. Midwest was flying DC-9s, and I think later on they were flying MD-80 aircraft. When oil prices hit and subsequent jet fuel prices soared, the business model of the industry changed. So you could no longer, if you wanted to be a successful airline, you could no longer fly flights that were not absolutely jam-packed, full of customers paying, top dollar for nonstop routes. So two across seating and the business model that Midwest had, it was unsustainable. And that business model is what we see today, which, as you said, that's why a lot of people consider flying a necessary evil, is because planes are packed, that, you know, there is no service, a lot of people would argue. And there are bag fees, there are change fees. So the entire industry model changed when the oil prices spiked. Now, oil prices have since come back down, but airlines realized they could make more money by having jam-packed planes, and the business model stayed. And airlines are profitable for the first time in many years.
We're talking with Joe Tashler right now. He's a business reporter and editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're talking about the revival of the Midwest Airlines, Midwest Express. And Joe, I can't imagine that starting, or in this case, reviving an airline is an easy thing to do. What is happening now that Midwest feels like it can break back into the market?
I think what has happened is the folks at Midwest, at the new revitalized Midwest, have seen just the power that that brand has in Milwaukee and Wisconsin. That brand, even 10 years after the airline stopped flying, is still incredibly prominent and well-known within the community. And that, coupled with the reduction that we've seen in service to medium and small-sized cities across, especially across the central part of the U.S., prompted the folks at Midwest to say, hey, here's an unserved customer base. We have this great brand. Let's bring it back and let's see what we can do.
And so for people who did fly Midwest before or who have heard the stories, how similar is the experience with the newly revised or rejuvenated airline going to be to what those memories might be?
Boy, there's two main similarities, and that is the brand name and the cookies. Beyond that, there are not a lot of similarities. The new Midwest is going to be flying regional jets, which are, they're not as spacious as what the old Midwest used to fly. Now, they do have to across leather seating in those regional jets, but they are in a smaller, more compact passenger compartment. Now you are going to get the nonstop flights to the cities that they initially want to serve, but in terms of for lobster dinners and that sort of thing, most people in the industry say that's not going to happen.
Now, as you noted, Midwest was known as Milwaukee's hometown airline, and there was a lot of kind of civic pride and loyalty because of that. Is it still going to be based here in Wisconsin, and what kind of jobs might it be providing?
You know, the company is going to be based here. They already have an office out at Mitchell International, or adjacent to Mitchell International Airport, so they are going to be based here. But at least at the start, they will be flying jets with a regional carrier out of Maine. Now, part of the reason for that is the barriers to entry to the marketplace are so incredibly difficult. You almost need a partner to start from scratch, like they're trying to do here. So the regional jets will be flown by a carrier out of Maine, but the brand and all the forward-facing customer interactions will be handled by Midwest.
And when are they expected to have their first flights?
You know, they have not announced a date yet. They expect, or at least say they hope, to be flying sometime by the end of this year.
And do we know what the first kind of round of destinations might be?
They have announced Cincinnati, Omaha, and Grand Rapids as their first three nonstop destinations. So those are three cities with business connections to Milwaukee that they see as underserved, and they're hoping the traffic among business travelers is strong on those routes.
And Joe, before we let you go, are you looking forward to your first flight on the new Midwest?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I like everyone else, remember those the heyday of Midwest, and you know, I've flown that airline, and I remember the cookies, and you could actually spread out in your seat, and I think the entire community is really watching and hoping that the folks seeking to bring this airline back succeed.
Well, Joe, thanks so much for bringing us up to date on the issue.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Joe Tashler is a business reporter and editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about the return of Midwest Express Airlines to Mitchell International Airport in Milwaukee. A new proposal making its way through the state capitol would make it a felony to assault Wisconsin nurses while they're on duty. Under current law, it's a misdemeanor. According to data from the American Nurses Association, 1 in 4 nurses reports being assaulted on the job, and 13% of missed workdays are attributed to workplace violence. Our next guest joins us to talk about the proposed legislation and why she and her organization are advocating for the change. Gina Denick-Champion is the executive director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. She joins me here in studio. Gina, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you very much, Judith.
Before we get into the legislation itself, let's talk about this issue facing nurses. What types of workplace violence do nurses experience?
The whole realm. It can be up to physical assaults, verbal, sexual. It can come from the patient themselves, a visitor, or family members. We've seen it increase over the years. We've conducted 2 surveys, one in 2012 and one in 2017, and we continue to see the escalation of those sorts of incidents happening, not just in our acute care, but wherever nurses work.
So it's not just maybe in an emergency room setting, for instance. It can be even in a nursing home or other places.
Correct. So in 1995, there was a statute created that provided this Class H felony to nurses working in the emergency room and other emergency room staff. That's sort of where you were finding those incidences. But now in 2019, you're seeing it on the unit, in the person's home, on the street, when a nurse is trying to, the hospice nurse is getting assaulted because they think she's bringing drugs into the home, all sorts of nursing, for sure the nursing homes, assisted living.
Do you have a sense of why it's increasing in frequency and where that violence is happening?
We do think that people are maybe more anxious, could be not sure lack of communication among family members. Certainly in some of our ERs and beyond could be gang violence related. People just maybe feeling out of control and anxious.
What are you hearing from the nurses who your organization represents about feeling safe or unsafe in their workplaces?
Well, based on some of the survey data that we have, they were pretty descriptive about what's happened to them, just in terms of the physical violence, being headbutted, punched in the face, thrown across a room, hit with some of the equipment in the room, being pushed up against the wall, slammed against the wall. Those are just some of the trying to actually strangulate the nurse, either with their stethoscope or the IV tubing. So those are some of the physical, the verbal, just very demeaning kinds of things, threatening to kill the person, threatening to kill their unborn child, and the sexual, it's the sexual.
And nursing is a profession that often suffers from shortages. It's not easy work physically, I'm sure emotionally as well. this can't help? Are you hearing from nurses that they are considering or actually leaving the profession because of this?
We just had the 2018 report of the nursing workforce, and within the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to lose quite a few. I don't have the percentage with me, but it's rather striking and rather alarming. Nurses give reasons for why they're leaving, but we never asked the question on the survey, was it because of? But some were just saying they're just disappointed with their work situation.
We are talking right now with Gina Denick-Champion. She's Executive Director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association, and we're talking about proposed legislation that would make it a felony to assault a nurse while on the job. And as we mentioned in the introduction, Gina, the American Nurses Association says that nationwide, 1 in 4 nurses report some level of assault on the job. And also going along with that is that only between 20 and 60% of incidents are ultimately reported. Why do you think that's the case?
When we asked that question about did you report, and the nurses responded, no, they did not. Some gave the reason that they didn't think anything would come of it. Others talked about too embarrassed. Others talked about it was maybe the type of patient that they were caring for, that they were being an advocate for their patient mm-hmm. before taking themselves and taking them the safety of themselves. And those would be the kind of patients that have your dementia or are developmental disabilities, are mentally ill, where they may not know that they have those issues, but after they get to know them, being harmed, they may report it, but not to the police. They're going to report it to the next shift so that the next shift knows about how to best approach that individual.
So keeping it internal within, say, the nursing team.
Yes. Yeah.
So those statistics of 1 in 4 nurses being assaulted at some point, low levels of reporting. Do we know if those are similar rates here in Wisconsin?
Looking at our survey data, it is. It is. And What we were really distressed about is nurses thinking that this was just part of their job. And it's very important that they report. Again, just to help the next shift, or if there really is an incident that needs to be addressed. Because, you know, if there's a family member or a visitor that is threatening you or causing physical harm, I'm sure the pattern won't stop. Yeah. So it's important that they report.
Let's talk about this legislation itself. If passed, this would make assaulting a nurse while they're on duty a felony. If convicted, a person could face up to 6 years in prison and a fine of about $10,000. Do you think that is an appropriate level of punishment?
When we looked at that, was the punishment that takes place in the emergency room. So all we saw that it was trying to leveling the playing field or bringing that standard across wherever nurses work. We also find that other Class H felonies, that same sort of penalty, it involves police officers, firefighters, wardens, those sorts of individuals.
So that's holding people accountable if they do commit that violence. But do you see that as being an effective deterrent? Because I'm guessing a lot of people, first of all, won't know that. And in those moments, whether that would even play in or not is a question.
We see this as maybe just one tool. We do, you know, I think nurses appreciate and trying to, and I know that different organizations are really trying to, how do I best protect myself when an individual is misbehaving or being very inappropriate. And it will empower the nurse knowing that I can do something about this. I hurt, I'm harmed, but, you know, this could stop this individual from harming another nurse.
Some mental health advocacy groups have raised concerns over the proposal, namely that people experiencing some sort of mental health crisis, maybe a developmental disability or Alzheimer's, could accidentally hurt a nurse without meaning to and then get charged for a crime. But you have a response for that.
We do. And the way the statute is written is we talk about intent. So when we say intent, the intent number one is that I want to cause physical harm. it's not that I'm scared and I want to protect myself because you're coming at me. It's about the intent of wanting to cause harm. And secondly, that they know it's a nurse.
Mm.
And when you think about those other individuals where some of those crises situations may happen, they may not know it's a nurse. They don't know who it is, but they're just feeling very threatened. So I can't see us, because we're advocates first, because we don't report mm-hmm. those instances, that we're going to do what the best we can and advocate.
This legislation has backing from some lawmakers, but it hasn't yet made it to the Assembly or the Senate. What would you like to see happen as the proposal makes its way through the legislature?
Well, first of all, we want to see it get out of committee as soon as possible. We're kind of hearing that there's some limited floor periods. We're really hoping that this can get passed this biennium. Be a great holiday gift for nurses if it was before then. But the other piece is the other healthcare providers are also wanting to be included in this legislation. And that's been brought forth as an amendment. And we have no problem with that.
Well, Gina, thank you so much for explaining the issue, and we will certainly be following it.
Thank you, Judith.
Gina Denick-Champion is the executive director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. She joined us today to talk about a new proposed bill that would make assaulting a nurse a felony in Wisconsin. Three Republicans are challenging President Trump in his 2020 reelection bid so far. Former South Carolina governor and congressman Mark Sanford, conservative radio talk show host and former Illinois congressman Joe Walsh, and former Massachusetts governor Bill Weld. But they won't have the chance to run against Trump in at least four states because there won't be primary elections. The Republican parties in Arizona, South Carolina, Nevada, and Kansas recently said they're canceling their 2020 presidential primaries, moves that aren't sitting well with Trump's challengers. Here's Joe Walsh on CNN on Monday.
Look, I've given up on the Republican Party. The Republican Party is a cult, right? They no longer stand for ideas. The Republican Party right now is all about washing their leaders' feet every day. That's what they do.
It's not the first time Republicans have scrapped primaries. Democrats have done it as well. But is it a good move for a party when they have an incumbent? Lily Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's also the author of Mad Men and Politics, Nostalgia and the Remaking of Modern America. Lily, good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me on today.
So tell us a little bit about the history of this. When has it been done in the past?
Well, it's not that often, but if it's done, it's during a race that an incumbent president is running. So in 2004, when George W. Bush was running for reelection, there were one or two primaries that were canceled. And in 2012, when Barack Obama was running for reelection, there were one or two primaries that the Democrats canceled. So both sides have done it. But four states is more than usual, and you have a number of challengers to the incumbent president who are coming from the party as well. Mm. And they, all three of them together, wrote an editorial in the Washington Post about a week ago where they sort of made their argument for their displeasure with some of these canceled primaries.
So just to be clear, in those other cases that you cited, when there were obviously different incumbents who were running for reelection, were there declared candidates in those cases when those primaries were canceled?
There were declared candidates in both cases, but I don't believe they were as well known as some of the primary challengers who are challenging President Trump.
So that's a little different this time around, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And who is making these decisions? It sounds like it's the state political parties that are deciding whether or not to have these primaries.
Yeah, it is. It's the primaries themselves are run by the parties, but they are sort of managed through the state board of elections, and the states themselves are the ones who execute the primaries or the caucuses. But the primaries or caucuses as such are organized by the parties and the parties in the states. and that probably wasn't clear at all. But essentially, the idea, and again, primaries and caucuses are newer in terms of how we get candidates and nominees. It used to be that the party convention would be the place where a lot of the sort of backroom deals were made and individuals were selected by party elites to be the nominee. And so the primaries and the caucuses that we now think of as how we go through this process is still coming out of reforms that happened in the 1960s and 1970s and so forth.
So there are these state parties for, well, not just for the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, but for other parties as well. But what about the national level party? Do they have any official or unofficial influence on states making this decision?
Well, they often are coordinating. The national party is often coordinating with the state parties in terms of these kinds of events. And the states themselves also have lots of rules and regulations with regard to ballot access and who can get on the ballot, particularly who can get on the ballot for the general election. But the states themselves, the state parties, sort of operate in a way in terms of what the format of the nomination process is going to be in that particular state. So in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Republican Party, the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, the Green Party, and so forth, they all sort of have rules and regulations about how the primary process is going to work. And as we all know about, like, Iowa has caucuses. And so it's up to the Democratic Party in Iowa, the Republican Party of Iowa, that they're going to work in the caucus structure as opposed to the primary structure.
We are talking about the decision by four states so far to not hold a GOP primary running up to the 2020 presidential election. Lily Gorin is with us. She's a professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha. And Lily, what reasons do parties give for deciding not to hold a primary?
Well, I mean, part of what is being cited is that it's expensive. So every time you hold in any kind of an election, it's expensive, or it costs money because you have to generate ballots, you have to organize it, you have to have people who are going to manage the polls or whatever the process is going to be. If you have caucuses, you have to have people who will manage the caucuses. And so all of that costs money, and that's the part where the state is essentially going to spend that money to print the ballots, to distribute them, to count them, to have officials who will, you know, sort of certify them. And all of that is something that the states do essentially in cooperation with the parties themselves, because the party comes in and says, hey, Wisconsin, we're going to have a Republican primary, we're going to have a Democratic primary, but you, the state, because you manage elections, you're going to manage it for us, essentially.
So that's one of the reasons given for not having them. Are there other maybe unspoken reasons that are more on the strategy level?
Well, strong challengers to sitting presidents in a contemporary period have weakened the president, the incumbent president, and where they have faced strong challengers, they have often not won the second term. So strategically, if we look at sort of historical situations, Jimmy Carter in 1980 had a strong challenge from Edward Kennedy. George H.W. Bush in 1992 had a strong challenge from Pat Buchanan. Where you have essentially internal challenges to the president from his, and it's only been his so far, from his party, oftentimes is a indication that the president is not as strong and goes into the general election having had to battle for the nomination, even as an incumbent.
President Trump was asked about his Republican opponents and the canceled primaries earlier this month. Let's listen to what he had to say.
The three people are a total joke. They're a joke. They're a laughingstock. And I have nothing to do. The four states that canceled it don't want to waste their money. If there was a race, they would certainly want to do that.
So, in fact, Gallup came out with a new poll today that shows President Trump has 91% support among Republicans. Given that, is there any doubt that he would be getting the nomination next year, even if there were primaries in every state?
It's extremely likely with those kinds of numbers that he would likely continue to be the nominee. But the three Republicans who are challenging him are challenging him on the basis of their understanding of the presidency and the Republican Party and what it stands for, and so forth. So it's not necessarily clear that any of them would be able to topple him or deny him the nomination. But having four states choose not to hold primaries means that they won't have an opportunity to even campaign against him.
We are talking with Lily Gorin right now. She is a professor of political science at Carroll University, and she's also the author of Mad Men in Politics, Nostalgia and the Remaking of Modern America. We're talking about the Republican presidential race and moves by a few state Republican parties so far to cancel next year's primaries. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? Are Republicans cheating their voters out of participating in primaries? Or is it better to save time and resources when the incumbent is up for re-election? Should political parties be prohibited from canceling primaries? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our discussion with Carroll University political science professor Lily Gorin. We're looking at the decision by the Republican Party in four states, Kansas, Arizona, South Carolina, and Nevada, to cancel their 2020 presidential primaries. And we want to know what you think about this at 800-642-1234. Should political parties scrap primaries? Are there occasions in which you think it's okay for them to do that? Or is it unfair to candidates and voters? If you back one of President Trump's Republican challengers, how would you feel if the Wisconsin GOP called off the primary? And if you are fully behind the president, do you think this is a smart move on the part of these parties? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phone. And Charlie in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I would describe myself as a fiscal conservative, but a socially liberal. And I am quite entranced, actually, by Governor Weldon. It would be very, very upset if that wasn't an option for me to vote for an actual legitimate candidate to challenge President Trump. Isn't that what the primaries were about, that we were trying to improve democracy and allowing people to determine who the candidates were? Isn't this defeating the real goal of what we were trying to establish with the primary system?
Thank you for that call, Charlie. And Lily, before I ask you to respond, let's go to Loretta, who's in McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Loretta. All right, let's go to Cindy in Appleton next. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Well, I think this is totally despicable. It's just another level of gobbledygook to take choices away from we the people. I just think really it's time for a ranked choice voting process.
All right. Thank you for that call, Cindy. And so, Lily, we also heard on Facebook from Jerry, if you cancel primaries, you're removing an important part of the democratic process and nullifying people's right to choose. People still need to participate in the process and vote. So quite a bit of opposition to the idea of canceling primaries.
And both the internet commentary and Charlie were sort of making a similar case that, you know, the primary system, as I said, developed out of part of reforms that was really an impetus for greater civic engagement by voters in choosing their nominees. And And so the primaries and the caucuses, which we have across the country, were to reflect the people's choices for their presidential nominees. And also, again, we have primaries as well for state-level offices and other offices, too, that lets, you know, the voters choose who they want to have represent them on the party ticket. And so some of these cancellations are, in fact, as the callers and emailers have noted, limiting their opportunity to, you know, have a say in who the nominee is.
Let's go back to the phones, and John in Madison is up. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I love what Cindy and Appleton was saying about ranked choice voting. I think if we had that, we wouldn't even have to have primaries. But what I was going to say is I sort of can see where they're coming from, where it does save money to not have a primary if you're pretty sure that the incumbent will win. That being said, freedom is expensive, and canceling a primary because you don't want to give the voters that choice sounds like something that would happen in a more authoritarian country like China.
Thanks for those thoughts, John. And Lily, for those who aren't familiar with the idea of ranked choice voting, can you explain that for us briefly?
Briefly, it's essentially an opportunity where a voter comes in, and instead of just picking one person, you rank the people who are on the ballot. And because of algorithms and amazing computer technology, we have the capacity to sort of run those ballots through and allocate the sort of numbered ranking accordingly so that you have the opportunity to sort of vote for your first choice and then your second choice and your third choice. And the person who may come out with the most votes may not be your first choice, but it may have been somebody that you, in fact, do support, just not as much as your first choice. That's kind of how it works.
Lily Gorin is with us. She's a professor of political science at Carroll University. We're talking about the decision of four, so far, state GOP parties to not hold primaries leading up to the presidential election next year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And I do think it's interesting, Lily, because it is the parties who are deciding whether or not to have the primaries, but it's the states who, as you said, organize it, print the ballots, have the staff there. Patrick on Facebook said, why do the states get to pay for primaries? I think he probably means have to pay for primaries. Let each party pay for their own primaries or reimburse the states. And Stephen on Facebook said, political parties are not a public entity, making the point that they can make these decisions if they want. He said, that said, I think the GOP has gone completely off the rails and needs a makeover. And, you know, it is an interesting point that the parties, it seems like an interesting kind of separation of duties and responsibilities that the party decides to have it, but then the state ends up paying for it.
Yeah. And I mean, and this is the complicated issues with regard to parties themselves, which is, you know, as one of the emailers or Facebook noticers noted that the parties are not public entities in that way. But the only people who can run elections are the states. It's a constitutional authority that they have. And so there is this sort of collaborative process with regard to the establishment of primaries and caucuses, that the way to run them, because you're asking essentially the entire constituency of a state to vote, is to have that run by the state itself. So it's regularized and the process is normal.
Wisconsin Republican Party Chairman Andrew Hitt says there are no plans to cancel our state's presidential primary on April 7th and that he's received no pressure to do so. Do you see more states possibly doing away with their primaries before next spring?
It's possible. And again, two of those states of the four that have decided to do this, South Carolina and Nevada, are early primary caucus states. So they're among the two of the four sort of first states to vote. And so a lot of the time, if there are challengers either to an incumbent or, again, with a sort of a broad field, as you're seeing with regard to the Democratic field, those first four states are ones where you will often see winnowing, as we say in political science, happening, where people will not necessarily make the cut, and then they will, you know, withdraw from continuing to run for president. And so the opportunity to have that happening with regard to the Republicans is limited because of South Carolina and Nevada sort of bowing out of having the primaries and the caucuses during their season.
Lily, you were talking about how a strong contender against an incumbent can weaken them, probably not knock them out, but weaken them enough that the party that's out of power might regain the presidency. But are there advantages to even a strong incumbent having primary opponents?
Well, basically, it moves the incumbent from essentially the role of being in office to being one who's now on the campaign trail, and so there is, you know, some argument for having the person, you know, engaging with voters and in different places, not in Washington, D.C., or not necessarily always talking to other policymakers. And instead, you know, essentially being a campaigner. But the sort of historical data indicates to us a real serious challenge from inside the party is also oftentimes reflecting fissures inside the party. So an incumbent president who has an internal challenge from his own party usually is also reflecting where there's disagreement about the direction that the party is going and that the leader of the party, the president, is taking the party.
And again, this presidency, it seems to be an outlier because President Trump has been having what he has clearly branded as reelection rallies, it seems, almost from the time that he took office.
Yeah, he filed his papers, I believe, on January 20th, 2017, to run for re-election in 2020.
Well, Lily, we will be watching this. We'll be looking to see whether other states follow suit with these four that have decided not to have primaries. And I'm sure we will talk with you again.
I'm happy to come back and talk about it again.
Lily Gordon is a professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's also the author of Mad Men and Politics, Nostalgia and the Remaking of Modern America. We talked with her about the decision by state Republican parties in Nevada, Kansas, Arizona, and South Carolina to cancel their presidential primaries in the run-up to the 2020 election. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, some of Wisconsin's biggest farming organizations are pushing back on proposed rules that would change the way large livestock farms are approved. We'll hear from producers who are on the other side of the issue. In our weekly look at news from around the state, more charges of alleged sexual harassment by a UW La Crosse professor are being reported. We'll find out about the school's response. And fall means apples. Food Friday topic tomorrow is preparing apples and the best varieties to use for cooking and other uses. That's tomorrow here on Central Time.